in that particular category. One other thing that I need to explain to the committee is this. The higher the category, higher grade contractors must be in the lower down. So for contractors on the lower band. Lower grade contractors may not be in the upwards. That's the way in which the register works. So immediately if you're grade 9, which has unlimited capacity and therefore may tender for any work of any value, is compromised, it means that you would have to literally split your tenders so that the lower guy are able to tender for the work, so that we are able to then deliver infrastructure. And for us, the biggest risk around all of this was the more we had to communicate about this, the more we made information available, and therefore the opportunity for fraud and corruption. That is why it was elevated to the strategic risk register. So the control procedures, what did we do? The very first thing that we did is we took this up in the departmental strategic risk register. You must remember at the time it was near education. There were rumblings in the newspapers and so on, but there was no real evidence and an investigation had to take place. The department undertook its own investigation into contracts procured during that period so that we could understand what would our exposure be should any investigation lead to a conclusion that there was actually collusion and who was involved in it and who were we doing business with at the time. The department then did the following investigations. One, look into and follow closely the Competition Commission's investigation into the conduct. You must understand that at that particular point in time there was nothing for the department to lay a complaint against any contractor because it was a mere allegation. And until we were proven to actually have colluded, the department couldn't do anything other than try and understand which contracts would be impacted upon if those allegations were proven. So we were following and we were in close contact then with the Competition Commission who undertook their own investigation. You also recall that what the Competition Commission did at the time was then to call the companies to voluntarily disclose any participation into collusive practices. The reason for this is simply, you cannot see from a tender process outright where companies outside of that process agree to participate or not participate in a tender, which was at the heart of what these allegations were about. In other words, just to illustrate, if you now take these grade 9 contractors, you will understand that each one of them lives somewhere in the country. And the nature of these allegations meant that each one knew where these World Cup stadiums would be built, and therefore they would meet and agree for which World Cup stadium they would tender. Which is also collusion because you would understand that what that does is it prevents competition in the open market for all of the stadia equal. So if they agree that, let's say for example, two of them would compete in Gauteng as opposed to the Western Cape, immediately there's no proper competition, real open and fair competition in the Western Cape for each stadium. The other thing that we did was then to understand and analyze what is the CIDB's response going to be. You must understand, and I've mentioned this before, in respect of infrastructure, the CIDB is for infrastructure procurement while the National Treasury is for general goods and services procurement. And therefore the mandate to take steps or action against these contractors falls within the mandate of the CIDB specifically. Now you must understand that there's a split mandate that we're talking about here. The Competition Commission, whose role is to ensure fair competition and open trade and the prevention of collusive practices. And secondly, the CIDB, who regulates the sector and its dealings with the public sector. So the CIDB conducted its own investigation and used the outcome of the Competition Commission eventually, of their findings, to basically do its work and then impose a penalty. At the time, the risk was one, blacklisting, because it would be anti-competitive and therefore, in terms of the Competing Corrupt Activities Act. Secondly, restriction, which is then a recourse that the department itself has to prevent that particular company found guilty from doing business. in terms of the preparation for European elections. Now, most of these investigations, the only full report that was released by the Competition Commission at the time. And that was because all of the disclosures and all of the incidents were voluntary, and then monetary penalties were imposed at the time, if you could recall. The outcome of the CIDB was an outcome of a different nature. This was not done like all of the other investigations which published on the CIDB website and circulated for the general public or the general sector to know what was going on. There was a meeting held where only the ministers were privy to an interim report. No physical documentation were distributed. They were briefed as to the outcome. And your very first question would be, why would that happen? So let's first understand what it means if all of the grade 9 or most of the grade 9 at the time, who were few and far in between, were found guilty. What that would mean for the sector is that the only players that are really able to do the big infrastructure in the country and to do the big subcontracting to the other contractors would all be found guilty and would all be blacklisted, meaning that you couldn't do business with them. So this was a very sensitive matter. The only thing that was subsequently put in the newspaper and actually tabled as part of the Minister of Finance speech was the voluntary rebuild program. Now the voluntary rebuild program, as it were in real terms, were not that voluntary, it was what it meant, but everybody that was found guilty of collusion, according to the Competition Commission's report, they had to participate in this voluntary rebuild program. And the money that they had to pay in penalties would go to this particular central fund in the National Treasury, where they, the contractors, they had to put something back into the community. Because remember, when we're talking about collusion and we're talking about money lost, we're talking about taxpayers' money. So you must understand it in that particular context. So for us as well, what we did is we did a regular checks on the CIPC, which is the old SIPRA, so the registrar of companies, for ownership and company profile verification to make sure that the companies don't exchange hands necessarily without us understanding what that impact would be, or morph into something else without us understanding which company we are talking about. We also, as a general norm, as you know, conduct compliance checks to ensure registration on the register of contractors. In other words, if the CIDB does not disqualify them from doing business, then the department itself cannot find a particular mechanism to say that they are not good for business, as it were. Because the CIDB, you must understand, governs both the contractors and the department as far as the public sector dealing with construction procurement is concerned. We also do due diligence that looks at plant equipment, ability, capability to do the job, bank ratings, references of previous projects, declarations. So you can call the previous occasion I just briefed this committee to tell you a little bit deeper into the process of what type of due diligence do we do. In other words, that those companies don't have anybody sitting in departments that could feed them with information. They sit working in the department and in the company. They have some sort of ownership in the company because the idea is that government shouldn't be doing business with government. In other words, you can't roll over these employees. You can't have employees and pay with their taxpayers' money doing business with government again in that particular context. Then we look at the BEE accreditation and of course the listing on the national databases. Now there are two national databases which are also referred to the committee to on a previous occasion. The one is the Register of Tender Defaulters. The Register of Tender Defaulters requires that you are found guilty in a court of law of a crime in terms of the Combating Corrupt Activities Act. And therefore you are blacklisted. And nobody, not government nor the sector, may do business with you. You are registered there as an individual as well as a company, and therefore your identity number and everything is disclosed to the CIPC to register different companies.
Probably they will not be getting this particular angle. It's because there are few, from what I understand from you, probably because maybe the government was thinking of the urban league, where therefore there had to be some compromise then. So just if you can explain, which is very unknown, in fact, given land share in my view. Corrupt people, maybe some of the problems that we're dealing with now are coming from that, because people know that they will be getting hundreds if they are taught to be specialized in particular fields. So I just want to understand that area there. Yeah, I think let's just stop there for now.
Thank you. Why do I know the subject? Yes, I worked there at the time, and yes, because of my knowledge and experience, and I have been driving the supply chain of the department since the inception of supply chain by the national trade, the infrastructure department. So yes, I understand it. I also participate in all of the legislation processes from the CIAD perspective, so it's my job to understand it outside of the files. The second part, the voluntary leave, to what extent did the program work? It's an ongoing program. I think the difficulty here was to understand, if you destroy these companies, what would the cost of the country be in addition to the money lost, so to speak? In other words, to the money that they have earned during the World Cup 2010 collusion matter. And how do you get it back? How do you get it reinvested in the people? Because it's taken from the people, literally. So it was balancing those two issues, literally, that was probably the motivation around the, or behind the approach. Because the smaller contractors or the other graded contractors, their fines is normally something such as a small penalty and for 3 months that I not do business or things like that. This is huge money. The money that I can tell you about is the fines that each had to pay, because that was harsh. The money that they had to give to the rebuild program, so collectively, there were 15 companies. The proposed penalties at the time that was tabled to these companies was 1.46 billion rand, which was the largest collective fine proposed yet by the Competition Commission with all of its work done thus far, 76 years almost. So it's broken down between the 15 companies, so we have the detail, we can give you that type of detail if you want it. And you must understand that these companies are not all Western Cape-based companies, and these companies do not just do business in the Western Cape. And like I was saying, the issue is, it's all fine and well to get rid of them and break them down, but at which cost? Because these are the companies that we sort of force through the processes to build up the smaller companies. These are the companies of old money, so to speak. So you want these companies to assist government through its delivery of infrastructure to be forced into a situation where they must, through that project, spend money on the smaller contractors and build up the smaller contractors. But if you cut away that level, you've lost the money already paid out to these companies during the World Cup 2010 projects. Then you're losing the companies and any investment, so they've gone with the money. Now they're bankrupt. They have subcontractors, and those subcontractors have subcontractors all dependent on these companies. And we're actually not saying that we necessarily agree. We're saying in this instance it was about finding the balance to at least get something back and be repaid or reinvested back into the communities from where this money was taken. So the voluntary rebuild program is a fund that was established where they had to the funding in terms of the funds that were collected, as well as some of the funds on an ongoing basis, and in terms of some of the infrastructure that they had to deliver over and above upcoming museums or whatever it may be. So I wanted to give you a different briefing on the voluntary rebuild program so that you have an understanding of it. No money was identified in this problem into the voluntary rebuild program. It's getting money back from the contractors into a fund in order for that fund to be invested back into infrastructure. Because technically, if you look at the reading, the money over and above what should have been paid, that the collision not take place, was money taken away from actual infrastructure delivery. So let's make an example. If a stadium, if a stadium should cost 1.2 billion rand, for example, to construct, and you're now paying 2.4 billion rand, you're paying for something equal to another stadium. That could have been a couple of hospitals, a couple of schools, etc., etc. And the question was, how do we get this back from them? Getting into legal battles with companies that have the money to keep you busy in court for years and years is something that one means government has to spend more taxpayers' money for long, and then not be assured of the outcome of such court cases to actually get the money or get some form of compensation back. So I agree with you that in terms of an amnesty process, it doesn't send the right message. But what you also need to understand is when you sit on the other side and you have to understand, when you have to make a decision about what is best for the industry, what is best for the community, how do we get the money back, how do we force these people into almost doing community service as in prisons and centers, if you like, as a comparison. How do you do that and what mechanism do you find? And that was the dilemma both from a Competition Commission perspective as well as a CIDB perspective. At no point does this send a message that these people get a blank check. These people, I don't know if you can recall, Chair, but there was a particular point when we first raised this matter with you that this committee wanted to engage the city of Cape Town that was actually about to sue one of these companies with whom they did business at the time for the stadium, for our stadium, to claim back in a civil suit from this particular company. So this amnesty, as you call it, is only a protection from one side. It does not preclude any civil action from any government institution that has suffered damage, which is something which is why we ourselves did an assessment to see, will we be the subject matter of these perspectives. So the research that again did no particular engagement into the voluntary rebuild project. And then, so I asked you about the extent that the program works. It's a continuous program, and we can get you some of the projects that's done under this program. But understanding that this is a countrywide program, it's not a program that sits within the realms of the Western Cape or is controlled by the Western Cape. It's actually controlled nationally.
Sure.
Thank you.
only the small one from what was used physically and what was rooted in this process. I'm not saying only from, and we know that money not necessarily come from the progress. National money, but also as progress, we must be overseen. But they might not be taken care of. So what I find difficult, maybe not from yourself, from the agreement that says we can't achieve because we want to mentor our upcoming businesses. That's what I find difficult. Maybe my philosophy is wrong.
Yeah.
You know, that's because you are expecting dealing, let's say, trade or flight, and therefore you can't be taken to this end because we have a responsibility and something that we must teach other people probably how to feel at some stage. You know? That's why I find it difficult. You know? And I'm not putting the to you because this is a national problem. You know? And I think maybe later on maybe we will deal with the issue where at least we get the details of the money that has been reflected in the province. So that maybe I also put my head into some ease. Because as it is, it's not as easy. You know, it's not right. Because you know what it says? It says to me, what corruption? You can go from it. And that's what many people are saying, that if you have money, you will win your case. This is what the crime is happening. Which is the problem, Chair.
Chairman, yeah. Yeah, we won't go on this one.
Thank you, Chairperson. And brilliant to the question, really touching it up. But I think the first question I've asked, and I've had time to address it, you know, the topic is being dropped, poor people being dropped, of many members. One thousand of us, and maybe then from your earlier point, this agreement, check on that, whatever laws passed after the Christmas National Day, whatever laws passed by government, the National Treasury rules, regulations, policies, to ensure that actually happens, that was agreed upon. You know, after maybe there is any proof that what has happened after the settlement and agreement to follow what you work back, that money, that's expensive. That's like that, right? You see after the years. That we think there must be an accountability from that company who accept it, agree, own up, and make a commitment. Because that is, if that didn't happen, then we are in this. And this compromise here was not to bring us back to the government effect or the opposite products. So it would be interesting to hear if there was follow-up, who's monitoring it, what department, the National Treasury, where in the President's office, or where, you know, where it's in order to show what might happen in terms of what was taken from the market. I think that's important for us to watch and learn.
Member Bill.
Thank you. Thank you for the informative presentation. What at the time boggled my mind was the ease with which these companies could pay back that money. So I just went to the bank and said, oh, here you go. You know, that's what bothered me. But to add to all the other comments and questions that we asked, how long, or if, have they been prohibited for a certain period as part of the punishment to not do it? Or was it just to pay a fine and then all is forgotten and you carry on?
Thank you.
If you start with the last one, first, they have not been prohibited. stand. So, let me start with saying this. So the department, at the outset, you must understand, have nothing to do with any of the decisions taken around these companies. I just need to distinguish this. Because anything we're going to do as a follow-up for you is to provide you with information that you would have to go and find. Because we were not infected by this from a perspective that we did business with them or that we they colluded in any of our things. The criminal justice system, and now there's two parts that must be distinguished, but the criminal justice system every day fails the victim in the sense that it makes deals. If you turn back a witness, then your sentence is a little bit more lenient than the one that doesn't. In this instance, which was not the criminal justice system, but the competition system, of which the Competition Act gives and empowers the Competition Commission to make certain decisions. The Competition Commission decides on a leniency approach. And the deal from them was, you come forward voluntarily, you disclose the full state of your corruption or your collusive practices. Exactly like that. And for that, you are fined a penalty. That didn't translate into a criminal charge of corruption, which in the norm would be what you would expect after you have evidence of people saying and admitting to corruption. So you can see that this juncture between, here's the Competition Commission setting the issue of competition, but also being the watchguard over and in a certain sense ensuring compliance to the Combating Corrupt Activities Act. Here are companies admitting, big companies, committing to corruption, but no criminal charge laid in terms of the Combating Corrupt Activities Act. Then the body that organizes and monitors the sector authorizes the mandate to conduct an investigation of its own. And to date, nothing was on the CIDB website to say that you are allowed to not do business with these companies based on that particular finding from the Competition Commission. And it was disclosed in the newspapers that the Competition Commission in fact handed over its report with all of its affidavits to the Construction Industry Development Board. So I agree that while we may not agree with the outcome from an administrative point of view, it is what it is. And from our perspective, we can merely do what is expected from us in terms of us making sure that we do not do deals with or in a way where we promote or we facilitate collusive practices. So I agree. The second thing is that the question about who monitors. This is a national program, and therefore the CIDB itself would have to monitor together with the Competition Commission and possibly report to the National Treasury. Again, I would have to find out this particular information because it is not in the domain of the Department of Transport and Public Works or the Provincial Treasury here. We are quite prepared to do that check, and when I brief you, I'm briefing you on the research done and not on my personal knowledge of how far this program comes and so on. But I can tell you, when the company speaks about this program, because it is part of our job to have an understanding of these companies, and what has changed about them, how the directors have changed, what controls they have been taken. They talk about it as some sort of a good thing that they're doing for communities and not a penalty that's imposed. So you can see the mindset even about the naming of the program and what it then means for these companies. Because if you look at a voluntary resource program, you almost look at it from the perspective of corporate social responsibility, not from the perspective of this person being guilty or as a punishment for
to my ignorance, I was responsibility was to actually come across this from an administrative point of view as your obligation towards your not really called an associate, but as a public servant, or whose responsibility was that?
So can the findings and the evidence state towards the Competition Commission? It was handed over, so let's make an example. The department when it undertakes or asks the PMA to undertake a forensic investigation. The PMA has to inform the HOD, the HOD then goes through the recommendations and agrees. Yes, so lay the criminal charge. We are also going to lay through the disciplinary. We are also going to do X, Y, or Z. Because she then sits with the outcome of the investigation or the evidence. So both the Competition Commission and the Construction Industry Development Board, in terms of its legislation that imposes upon it a duty to undertake an investigation of its own in addition. So let's say the Competition Commission doesn't have funds, but the CIDB can't fund it. They would also have an obligation to take certain steps. Which is why I'm saying the people in charge of or who is in position of authority over how the sector would function, what is the legislation, what is the norms, what is the standard, what is the code of ethics, those are the people that send me these reports. Those are the people where we, if we have any findings, that's where you would take it for them to deal with it in terms of their name. Or pick up a red flag of corruption, we report it for investigation. to the places which you go when you do your annual report, you will see. There are monthly engagements from the National Paper Secretary. There are weekly engagements from the supply chain perspective, because we are supply chain department. We encourage staff. It's something just very funny to you. Report it rather than sit with the knowledge that something didn't look right but you didn't say anything about. Because solutions must understand is something that is not open and in terms of necessary documentation. It could be verbal agreements between people. And therefore, you make doubly sure in your statements that you don't see people participating in this contract, in that contract, in the other one, and not trying to understand what's the link between them, and etc. So I agree that only to the extent that we have proof of what it is that we allege. Because even the whistleblowing policy legislation actually says, if you do not have proof, and it looks like a malafide claim, an allegation that you're making, purely to get to somebody, so to speak, then they could charge you with a criminal offense. So we do find ourselves in a difficult space when we need to understand when we complain, when don't we complain, how do we do it, and what evidence do we have. Which is why every time that I speak to the committee about contractors at fault, I make sure that you understand that a contractor at fault isn't a saying that a contractor that colludes or is corrupt. It's just that they fail, which happens in certain contexts. So that's the first part. The second part, Chair, is I know why you're trying to say that the Western Cape can't give you evidence. The thing about your very first question to them was, what legislation was subsequently passed? The answer is nothing from a legislative perspective, but from a national treasury perspective. You would recall that the Parliament last year, the year before last time, gave you a presentation on the Central Supplier Database, which in our context was like a duplicate of the Western Cape Supplier Database, because nationally there was nothing. So it was very difficult for them to connect people to each other and connect companies to employees, etc. So the National Treasury since that did do a massive amount of work to make sure that the government has information. You must understand that the thing about corruption and collusion is it can only take place where there's plenty of information. And if we don't have it, but the sector does, we are sort of on the back foot, so to speak. When I say that from our perspective we don't find out, the voluntary rebuild program, like any fund, is something that will have its condition controlled by national, which they will send out the rules of engagement to the parties affected first. In other words, if you have a city of Cape Town that was affected in this instance, and you have a municipality that then lost money, so to speak, the idea of the voluntary rebuild program and the money, the penalties paid, is to first try and recover some of the damages and losses suffered as a result of that type of thing. So this is a process that's going to take years for us to cause one leg round, so to speak. When I'm talking about getting the information, I'm talking about our member judge's previous comment. What is it set for? What was built? Those types of things. Because that is not something that was built in councils and public works. For us, what we try to find out, in no way was there any policy documentation, even on national religious website pertaining to this is how you access the rebuild program, the voluntary rebuild program. So that's why I'm saying we will make a concerted effort to go and get you the particular information so that you can see what has rebuild where, when.
I guess that is obviously why I've been talking with the interested members. I think you will be concluding to try to gather a little bit more information. And it does appear that what is now happening is that the funds that were paid in terms of penalties, as well as an additional $1.5 billion on top of that, has gone into what's called the Turisano Fund. So through from the National Treasury, the National Revenue Fund, the National Parliament appropriates money into what's called the Turisano Fund. And it seems to outline what they presume it unfolds in bursaries for studies for maths and science for schools and things like that. And that in 2018, April 2018, at the time it was
aka malpractice and corruption. Is there, or can we be good, that you come and give us a presentation on how it is possible that a situation like as is in Georgia happens to the extent that it happens? Where did it begin for within the cracks in that? If we can go forward with the chief.
We'll discuss that. That was just a question that we don't need an answer of that one. We'll discuss that. Absolutely, you can continue, and then we can. Thank you very much.
So the second part of the presentation, the members of this call, your question was that we will come and give you some more information pertaining to our framework agreement and the type of support that we put in place in order for us to build upgrade 1 and 2 contractors, which is definitely in the worst spectrum, into feasible alternatives. So let me start off by telling you grade 1 and 2 in terms of contractor grading is by far the most in numbers on the register. It is not sustainable. And government will never have that numbers of work opportunities to afford each one an opportunity. The problem with that is these are also survivalist contractors. In other words, they're job seekers. They don't have a sustainable income, they don't have ground and equipment, they don't sometimes have training or the skills to actually build anything. They're survivalist contractors. Added to that is many of them doesn't have an idea of how to run a business, how to put together a tender, where to go and get this money, what type of bank account they should have, and these are the basic things that they get wrong. So from the start, from a basic point of view, why did you and I did brief the committee on this before, is I've established a section in my unit under a police and a member today, where they go out into communities and they teach them about tax returns. Register with tax, your tax and not the enemy. You need them. If you're going to have a business, you need them. We are paying you with taxpayer money. This is how you register. This is how you do a tender. This is how you complete a form. Sometimes completing the forms for them. Sitting in churches, in school halls, wherever we get the opportunity after hours to help these communities to get registered and try and teach them the basics of procurement. I'm sketching this particular context to you so that when I explain what we are trying to do, you understand who we are talking about. They cannot afford lawyers, they don't have professional architects and QSs and things on their establishment. These are not those contractors. These are job seekers. These are people that just want to earn a decent wage and buy food. This is the basis of what we're talking about. So what we've done is the very first thing about these contractors is grade 1 are only allowed to tender for contracts up to a maximum value of 200,000. Now you have to send this to your cost 200,000 rand. I'm not saying you're going to have 200,000 rand in their pocket. I'm saying the total quantum, the value of the quote may not exceed 200,000 rand. This means there will be a capital outlay for them, which is problem number one, to access this particular opportunity. Of this 200,000, they're going to make a fraction as a profit which goes back into their pocket. They are not going to use that money to put back into the business in order for the business to sustain itself in order for them to get more work. So that's why I'm giving you the scenario of these contractors are. So what we need is trying to find a way to get these contractors, or some of them at least, into a program where they are sure they are not competing against 10,000 other drivers. So we designed what is called framework contractors in place for a financial year or a number of years. Because in order for them to register in the next year in a higher grade, they must prove that they have done one project, one project number to website, there will be a chimera body or things or plants. This comment is a warning to a number of contractors at the same time, so not just one contractor. A number of contractors get awarded this contract in a certain area, and when the type of work comes up in that area, they are given the job. So we rotate amongst them, and not that they have to tender continuously, because then you'll end up with a one winning the tender every single time for the quote. What we have done is, one, we teach them how to sustainably tender, complete a tender document. Two, they don't have to worry about where does the next job come from necessarily for this period of time, because they know if that job comes from that particular area, they are in line for this in the next whatever amount of round. Let's say there's 4 contractors. Then 3 contractors from now begin later. Understanding that we've done an assessment of how much of this type of work is in each particular area, therefore, by the time period for the contract. Then it enables them to then in the following year, after they've done this work, it enables them to go and apply for registration in a higher level, meaning they are tender for jobs in a higher value. In order for us to provide them some sort of assurance almost that when they tender, they are able to be pulled and taken from the one grade into the other grade. Now the problem with the grade ones again is there are too many grade ones for us, for Transport and Public Works, for the entire government together to sustain all of them. This matter has been taken up on the legislative committee with the CID on a number of occasions. They are not stopping the registration on their grade ones at any particular point in time. And what that does is it creates the idea for people that somehow they're going to have a chance at a tender, which is why some of the expectation is sometimes not controlled, because you are creating unrealistic expectations when you do that. So there's 42 type of contracts in place for this financial year currently. The grade 1 and 2 participate in 33 of these. So you understand that they also have more complicated work, higher values, and for those that can't, because they are not allowed to take any of those, that's why I split out from the 42 that number in which the grade 1 and 2 are allowed to participate, which is 33 out of the 42. The main framework contract for grade 1 and 2 is our SL31. It's a multidisciplinary day-to-day maintenance contract. Why is that important? Why that is important is every time that they get a job, they will have that one contract number, which they can say in total the amount of work and the value of the work that I did for this year under that contract is X. And it is that who I am for them to apply for a higher grade. We also provide contractor training every month in what we call framework for management group meetings. What this is about is these are not contractors that understand infrastructure contracts. So we teach them infrastructure contracts, because the higher up they go, the more complicated the contracts get, and therefore they need to be familiar with what are the green and what is the right and what's the right of the principal agent and what's the right of the department, and when can they go and complain, and what is the type of things that they can complain about, and what must they know in order to them to run their business. There's also a contract development program with EPWP, a construction information session. This is normally a program that we report on in every annual report, so you are familiar with this program. And the idea of that is for us to teach them tendering, teach them preferential procurement, teach them what do they need to do to get their BE in order, their BE credentials, and what is their credentials, and how do they get to follow it up. Teach them business skills, cash flows, etc. One of the other ones, of course, is for them to do one may say we are not comfortable ever back to do business with them, which is for us one of the due diligence checks that we are doing. So we teach them these things so that they understand how to maneuver through the process and the due diligence and things that we are going to require from them. Then there is the professional, the registration of suppliers, which I explained to you earlier on. And this is also done in close collaboration with the Department of Economic Development and Tourism, as well as various municipalities. Now, the question is why? If it comes to the Department of Economic Development, you must understand that what they do is they have funding where they do fund certain types of investments in certain types of business. So we try and bring them closer to the communities and closer to these contractors so that the contractors understand to which government institution you may need to go to for what type of service and what is being offered. What I've done here is just to give you a list, and can I have an email back, the Excel spreadsheet so that you can actually see it. Because I don't want to tell you we have 42 framework contracts and for 33 of them suppliers do business with us and you don't know if it's real or not real. If all real is there and we have the contract, the number, the names of the contractors to whom those contracts have been awarded to. So that if one wants to start monitoring the process, you are able to do so and even see which of those contractors fell by the wayside and as far as they were not able to deliver to the quality, understanding that we're also not there to just give them the tenders. We need to teach them the responsibilities in terms of quality infrastructure delivery, the responsibility that they have for the safety of whoever uses the buildings when they are going to conduct certain work on our behalf. This is just a list, like I said, and there we highlight in red for you the contract that we spoke about, which is SL 31/16, which is the Western Trade Market Disability Legislative Maintenance Contract. This one, what I'd like to you here is an extract from the Register of Contractors. I think. Why? Because this is a regulation from the Construction Industry Development Board. What this shows you is the designation. In other words, the contractor grade in designation. And you will see they grade 2,650 because grade 1 is up to 200,000 rand. And they don't have to show any previous projects conducted in order to register, which is why they're not on the list. So that's the start-up job seekers, like I said. So you can see that in order for grade 1 to become a grade 2, they have to show that they have performed a maximum value of 650,000 rand in one contract. Can you understand that if a grade 1 contractor only gets a 200 rand job per contract, you will never be able to show that unless we create some sort of program around them to be able to do so. The largest contract completed during the 5 years immediately preceding the application in the course of construction was applied for, they conducted 150,000 rand. What does that mean? They don't just apply for grading designation, they also apply for cost of work. In other words, if you are going to do planning, then you must show that in order to become grade 2, if you're grade 1, that you've done work to the value of 130,000 rand in the planning field in order for you to register as a grade 2, and so on and so on. So I'm giving you this table so that you can understand what are the basic issues these contractors face in order for us to develop them from a grade 1 to a grade 2. And this is the regulation. In other words, there's no negotiation around this. They register at the CIBD and it's the CIBD that processes their particular information.
Just to link the previous conversation with this one, we were talking about the difference of the grade 8 and grade 9. It's interesting that if you then look at that table and the little column which is the maximum value contract value, is that if we didn't have grade 9s available to us, the maximum value that we'd be able to have at any tender is 150 million rand, because that's the maximum to which a grade 8 is allowed to operate. So as the committee would know very well, within our roads environment specifically, many of our roads So if I may just flag that in the
evening. Any other questions? I just want to ask one question, and I know the discussion that we had with the late one and the two last time. You're putting a lot of effort into these contractors, the grade 1 and 2s. Do you keep a record of those that's promoted to the next level, maybe level grade 3? And if guys fall through the cracks, do you address that, and how do you deal with that? So that, because that was our big concern, the 1 and 2s. And like you said, the job seekers and they got other lane recovering things. But all your effort and, you know, everything that you put into these guys, do you have at least a progress report to say, listen, if you start from there, we cannot leave him alone at grade 3 or grade 4, or don't you keep track? I'm sure you keep track, but I just want to, you know, we can maybe ask the list or something later, but you know, how effective is your intervention? Because it's a one thing. So how effective is your intervention, and is it bearing any fruit? You know, that is what I want to ask. Thank you. No other questions? Member Chatter, please.
Thank you, Mr. President. I hope the presentation of the case is only for the community. If you go out and make the presentation in a manner that you have done to the community, you will get a lot of fight from people in grade 1 or grade 2. Remember, some of them are not necessarily up to it. Some of them, they are professionals who some of them decided to leave. Probably they are okay because they want to be on their own to start to do something and employ other people in the process. They are contributing, you know, you want to say that they're great employment. So I think that's what I would ask to. So there's a lot of the question. To find a fight among them. I know the issue chair that I want to raise in this, I see the framework, and to you were saying you have got something that might. So I don't know. In the process, because we have got two in my room that are paying value, what are you doing in the process to prepare others that might be in the next coming 7 years? Or how many years do you take serving to that program? So that those who are not in the program, they must not complain and say, only certain people they told me the one who are being sorted out. So that's what I want to understand.
Thank you.
Okay.
So let me answer the last question first. The framework, the issue around building the committee around the framework started off with the reporting on the framework in the annual report. The framework isn't the only thing that we do. The framework is one intervention. It's not the only tendering mechanism in the department. The grade ones, remember, are all registered on the Western Trade Supplier Register. They are linked to quotations that they receive, that they receive on the cell phone, which they get messages, for which the I tender sending messages to say, there's a tender for you, you registered in this category, please don't collect it. Again, I need to bring in the context. We will never have enough opportunities to cater for all of the grade 1s and grade 2s. There are simply too many registered in their grade. But while I say that, they have no competition. In other words, the brain wants to compete against each other in their class of work for that job. So I agree with your statement, and I understand fully and I appreciate fully the issue around not saying they are unskilled. That didn't mean in any sense that they are all unskilled. But there are those that have no skills, and for them, we have a particular program also for EWP. These are all limited by the funds that we have available for the development of these contractors. And every day what we are trying to do with the bigger contractors is find other ways, indirectly, to ensure that they go and invest in these smaller guys, link them up with these smaller guys, build it into our tender documentation that if you are going to create this tender in that municipality, these are the contractors that are there and you must use a contractor from that area, that type of thing. So that there are a number of other mechanisms that we employ. The issue was how do we get them to show, to demonstrate that they meet this particular requirement so that they are able to rebuild or to register in the next higher grade. So you are right when you are asking the question that we don't make them feel like some of them are left almost in the cold. They are not. But what it means is from the development program, we only have the capability and the limited funds to target a certain number as it were directly. That doesn't mean that we don't have indirect mechanisms, which we do, and some of which I have mentioned to you now. You must also remember that on the previous occasion we did present to this committee the empowerment impact assessment that we do for all projects above a certain value, a certain rand value, in which we identify the number of opportunities for that particular project in that particular municipal area. And that is built into the tender document, and therefore, if you want to call it that, the local project, the use of local skills, whether it's for actual physical skilled work, or to sell products, or to buy products from, or to buy services from, while we are actually delivering the infrastructure in that particular community. The second part of the question was about keeping pace and bearing any fruit. Change is quite an interesting thing that happens amongst contractors, which is the following. Contractors get tenders for the department, isn't it likely to tender for the city of Cape Town? Contractors that work for the city of Cape Town doesn't mean the norm tender for project with the department. That you come to the department and you ask complaints, you think it's an archive advice, which we do give, because we register all of them regardless of who they choose to tender. But ultimately, what happens is as they move through the grades, remember, we almost every month and we know our contractors and we immediately know this one sounds unfamiliar. I haven't come across them yet. Because you grow with these contractors, you know them. We report on each tender award, we report on each tender plan, and therefore, their names come up, and we have the records of who has been awarded. Are they now grade 2? Where do they stand, and so, and it's easy for us to follow. But the problem is when you say, is it bearing any fruit? I also want to say, can I answer the question with a question? In the context of saying, against which, or compared to what? Because compared to the number of grade 1 contractors registered for a certain class of work, I would contend no, we are not nearly doing enough. But we are not, from my perspective, but we are not nearly doing enough because we have not have that kind of money to do more. You can only do it with the project that you currently have and with the money that you currently have. And now in this economic environment, there's a new danger, a new risk, and that is that our grade 8 and 9 are failing. And if the grade 8 and 9 are failing, folding, lucrative companies listed on the stock exchange are failing, what chance does it want to do that? So you are also trying to build from this side and then from an economic perspective, there's a almost, you know, breakdown, so to speak, in the chain of what makes when I know there are some integrated ones and twos are registered, who will kind of never have a say. Not because we don't like the system, not because that's simply for the numbers.
Do you have a question?
Information management systems and connecting all of these different parts.
So we have started from an internal point of view having that type of conversation. What we have already done, and what Kazeka will present in the next slot, which is linked to our bursary program and the risks that we've identified around youngsters, there being insufficient youngsters coming through the school system with the requisite grades or appropriate grades for maths and science, obviously, that are the two prerequisites for you to be accepted into the university, into the higher education institutions, for you to study engineering, quality surveying, architecture, etc. And that has been one of the potential limiting factors for us. And so Kazeka will actually, in the next presentation, give you a sense of the work that we've been doing, trying to do with the Department of Education around that. So understanding that that's now a bottleneck for us, and we've got to go backwards in the pipeline, you know, continuously to try and find ways to solve those problems. So she'll give you a sense of that. But I'd like to speak about, and I'm sure the committee, obviously, because it may not be in the Public Accounts Committee, but you're all members in different committees, that in the Provincial Strategic Goal 3 of the provincial government, there's an approach that we're looking at and working on called the Whole of Society approach. And formulating based upon a number of areas as the kind of the test case and for government and society to get together and to try and deal with some of the aspects around how do you get the growth and the development and so on in those communities. And so the provincial government chose Saldanha Bay as one of the areas, Drakensberg was another one, Mananda kind of a park was another area, and then Khayelitsha as well. And as an example, within the Mananberg region, if I can use that, just to give you a sense of where some of the conversations have got to talk about how we get younger people into work and all different opportunities and bring it all together, is that as you'd be well aware, there has been conversation for some time around the hospitals, the schools, the development of the city in terms of the engagement in Mananberg with the youth lives. Our campus that the Premier has spoken about for a number of occasions in her State of the Province address. And through a program and the development of community action plan, which is with the community, with the representatives of the community, and an agreement on an action plan, the teams have been sitting, they had a review process, I think it was in April this year. And in one of the conversations, a community member said, it's great, thank you very much, we know all about the infrastructure, that's wonderful. But actually our problem in Mananberg is waste. Okay? And because there's a perception created that if the area is untidy because there's refuse blowing around and so on, that gives me a question about who we are as people. And of course that's fundamentally flawed, that's just what comes through as a this is what the lady from the committee is saying. And she said, the problem for us is that the city of Cape Town only collects one refuse bin. There's one bin per earth that's allocated. But because we've got backyard dwellers, there's more refuse created that can fit in one bin. So that gets put on the side. And when the city comes and collects the refuse, they only take the bin, they leave the bag. And then you've got stray animals and so on, and the wind comes up, and so the stuff gets ripped apart, and the rubbish gets washed away, gets thrown away. So the point being, I'm sorry, I am a big car chair, I'm sorry, but it's something, if you don't mind, I'm very passionate about, and I think it gives you a sense of what we're trying to get to as a department as well. That the remark was then made, oh well, the people will just then get another bin, they will pay for another bin, and the city will then collect the other bin. But the backyard person is saying, but I can't afford that amount in terms of 100 grand or 150 grand a month or whatever it is for that bin. So the question then becomes, well, what is the solution? Because now you've got backyard dwellers, which perhaps is as a result of overpopulation, as a result of insufficient housing, as a result of, and you can start flowing the chain all the way through. And when you start thinking about refuse as a problem that's really going to be something meaningful for the community to be able to solve, you start thinking about recycling programs, different kind of economic opportunities that you can then put
how do you bring the community and create the opportunity for a community in that context to create small co-ops or whatever, link them with SARS, with CIPRO, with this one, with that one, to create businesses that are sustainable. We then are starting to talk about, as one needs to go through processes to demolish infrastructure and rebuild, are there opportunities for us to create small businesses within the community to put the tender in place? It's not a big contractor coming in and demolishing. It's something that the community can then use. Maybe the steel and so on can be used in for somebody who sets up a little shop almost down the main street through Dana Fontaine of Nuremberg, that they can manufacture tables and chairs and different sort of things that they can then sell, and people can come from anywhere across Cape Town to come into the area to buy and to participate and add value into the economic environment and space. So these are things, we have a lot of the answers, right, Chair. You know, we're not sitting here with all the answers, but I am trying to explain, based upon Honourable Member Joseph's question, that we are trying to find some of the ways to create sustainable solutions that are not only in HBW space, but working with culture, faith and sports, community, safety, environmental affairs, and tourism, city education, all of the different role players, trying to find a way to create sustainable environments for our communities, with all of these different opportunities. But that it's not government coming in saying this is what we're going to do. It's actually something that's come out of the community, which then is going to create the buy-in and the way in which the community is going to protect, if I could use that word, what lands is happening, because there's ownership and there's a real sense of investment in it. So, thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Before we go to the next item, there was a request for a 5-minute break. So there is tea or coffee if you want a tea or coffee, but there's a few people that want a break. So then you'll get it for 5 minutes. Sarah's got the most. Sarah, okay, good. So it's a VR time coming back now that we don't stay long and that we don't have to ring the bell. What? Quarter two. We're back at quarter two.
Okay,
thank you.
They ask the questions and they don't give the answer.
Thank you.
Yeah.
No, you didn't say that. I'm asking the question. They what?
There's a lot of challenges that they experience, and that impacts their capability to
There's a voluntary service, there's a separate program, and there's an involuntary service. Voluntary one is whereby you as a student, you say, I need help, and then we give academic support. And involuntary one is whereby if you are getting 59% and below, we identify your service, and then we force you to take academic extra classes. That is academic support. And we force you because the problem is if a student is getting 59%, chances of that student then going to 49% extra classes. Then what we have is we are going to identify for the okay? The first one is this is what I'm saying. This is what that the student, and I always say, and I think my intro people know this how we say that, is that it's not a reflection on what they are able to do. If it's an asset sector, maybe the student will be. This reflection of ability is not their fault. We create them. Okay, because the fact that we have given them a kind of education that doesn't help them, that is the reason. Then what is the impact of this? What the university is, because remember with us as a partner program, we have various partnerships. We have partnership with universities, we have partnership with partners of education, we have partnership with NGOs, we have partnership with companies, there's a lot of various partnerships that we have. And why do these have that? Because if you look at universities, they are trying to get it over this type of program that we're asking about people from the Spanish community. What the universities have come up with? They have come up with something that is called extended degree program. If a course is a 4-year course, then it is a 5-year course. It's not a pressure course. Most people, they always think it's a pressure course. It's not a pressure course. What do they do? They increase the number of subjects that students are doing. Instead of the students doing a 4-year course within 4 years, they allow them to do 5 years. That means there is a distribution of subjects. That means that then if you are going to take certain subjects, you end up taking 4 subjects. Because remember, no kind of education has some limitation. But if you are doing only 4 and you have academic support, you will be able to pass. That is what the problem is about. And it's a good problem, by the way. That is why people, when they say it's a prison course, they say, no, it's a prison course. It is not. The prison course is way back, you're still going to do SSA. With this one, you are doing SSA, it's just that you are doing with a limited subject. The other applicated one, which is an extra year that is utilized by you. And the universities have come up with that in order to be able to accommodate people coming from the Spanish communities. And what is it that we are doing with the Department of Transport? What we have done, in our 22 of the program, we have accommodated that extended year. Instead of giving a bus driver for 4 years, we give it for 5 years to accommodate that extra year that's given by the universities. Secondly, because one of our certain potential criteria is that we need to come from those areas. Then we have what is called social assessment. When you go to universities, immediately we have a multiple system whereby we identify our partners, what we mean in their final year, and then we attach to our best students. So that is more of a strategy we're going to tell you where the next is. Like, whenever you have issues with the university, you know where to go, and that person will be there, your killer to help you, and you have those to try and make sure that these kids that are in this extended program, they will be able to address it with university life. The outcome that we have, performance of financial disadvantage, we as a program, we are in a position to indicate that we have managed to empower people from the disadvantaged community and we have given them access to social education. And then there's this, our partners generally have no normal, we tend to hear about majority of them, they have a head of pain. With that, we don't really have that kind of situation because of two, social assessment and the academic support that we give. Then again, it's a boundary of risk that I've set. This risk, what you can do, it is required. As remember I told you, once you start talking about asset empowerment, it means you need to challenge this data. So we need to have innovative measures and support that are required to make sure that our people can get. In order for us to have a fitting pipeline that is going to be representative of the research groups in South Africa, we need to make sure that we have that fitting pipeline. We cannot make an excuse that kids that are coming from the Spanish community, they are affected and disadvantaged, and we end up failing them. That is not us. What we have to come up with innovative ways to make sure that in a certain moment we are in a position to control this case. This is what we are doing. We have an outreach program. Our partners, our strong academic, strong partners, we require them to participate in outreach program. Because what we want them to have, you know, there's any role that works with the What we do all of us have, we need them to this angel, and they ask us, they become one of the tutors. And then they ask us to perform the preparation schools so that they understand the subject. They pass them. So that is admission for these courses. So, like, the thing is that they require, for your students, then what you need to get to the practice and then have to be admitted. And, like, that is just, it's not like it's going to be right from the top. That's why then we need the skills to be assisted and making our kids, our partners to assist. Then we have that, we have indicated, we have this academic support. Immediately, once you are with us, once you are one of our partners, then we have you. The outcome that we have, completion of special education for our students. Majority of our students, I think we have a very small number of people in the program because the aim is not to give you a master, it's for you to complete. That is game one. It's for you to complete because at the end of the day, you want to school the skills. Then I have to say at the fact that we need to make sure that we get a real pipeline of one to one. That is why we have leadership with NGOs and we ask our partners to us so that we have these kids so that their potential can really be maximized and we are able to get them. And what we also do with universities, what we do, we inform them that we have money to give for masters, but this is the type of masters that we require. In that way, we are putting universities to make sure that they have kids coming from disadvantaged schools. Because we say we are going to give a master, but this is the criteria and we need to give up that type of students and they give us. The other thing that we are doing is to make sure we have such programs, sense of social responsibility. Our masters, they need to know that, you know, all about us, all of us have an issue. They have a social responsibility. Government has a social responsibility. Companies have a social responsibility. Everybody who we are working with, we are instilling to them. Even our mentors, we tell them this is a social responsibility. You are not going to be rich in terms of this program, but it's your social responsibility to do something. Then at our time, we want everybody to know that we have to take collective accountability in terms of our government initiatives. It's not government, it's not the Department of Education, it's not higher education. It's everybody's responsibility. That is why we didn't instill that with our partners. You have a part of the play in making sure that the skills are accurate in the country. All of us, the companies, that is why we have that. Everybody, there should be a collective responsibility and accountability that we need to make sure that our country does have the skills. And we need to understand that we need to challenge the status quo if we want to make it right. Then the other one that I've been talking about is unfortunately for transfer students in engineering, like, it doesn't appeal to younger people. It's better to be doctor, you know, all these things, they are less disciplined. Because they don't really like this discipline. Now what we do, we try and market our discipline so that people understand. And secondly, people they think, I don't know whether they think of it's more, the environment is more favorable than I'm talking about the working environment, I'm not talking about the requirements of the course. I'm talking about the working environment. Because we have to be excited and the long hours and all that. Maybe that is what the risk is so male dominated. I don't know. But what we are doing, we are trying to try that situation. These are the things that we are doing. We have fortunately to the Department of Education. The Department of Education is serving in our board. And secondly, what we have meetings with principals, life orientation, teachers, what we have even have for that, whereby we ask from them, who are their kids that have been selected for me, and then from there we go and back into the discipline. Because once people are vocalized from the different things, most of the time we think of other disciplines besides the ones that we're looking for. In terms of our selection, Chinese theory, as I said, very late donated, I don't know why, but what we have there in terms of our selection criteria, sometimes it's given to historical disadvantaged groups, especially female people with disabilities and those who are fighting in the right. And then people themselves, they ask, how can you be an engineer when you are a person with disability? You can be a consultant, you can do design, there's lots of things that you can do, even if you have disability. And by the way, there's various types of disabilities, there are the ones that they can be accommodated in the industry. We also have leadership and direct engagement with disability networks and NGOs working in terms of improving disability. Because even now, even that we have lost, I think we have 5 can be minimal number, but to have that is an achievement for us, of people with, of students with disabilities. We try and make sure that we have. And there's also one who has already been employed. And we try and make sure that they are in the specific and they can be but as we kind of have indicated initially that if they have a kind of problem, we make sure that they are active in terms of our struggle. The other thing that they also do, which I don't have, is to the country, also himself, would that his data as private, come up as private, and try and make them as a child. Because at the end of the day, as we have said, our collective responsibility to make sure that this is a child. The outcome, we are trying to make sure that the city life is able to enhance the community. We would like to have a situation whereby, when you talk about professional assimilation to deal with the representativity that comes nowadays, yeah. That is why. And the process is starting because we're already started getting people from self-managed groups that are getting professionals that from that are doing this. The result of assessment as I have, this is the list that we have, these are the subjects we have and the campus specifically, and then we have subsets of modules. Remember, campus subsets, they have more than one module. We have subsets in modules, and then we have participants. Remember what I told you, with our participants, either you are caught or you didn't. When you see the previous contact and there's no indication of whether the person failed, because it means that what they will return the contract. The person has said, I'm coming with the subject, I haven't failed, but please help me. That is the case. Then you have a list of the people who have participated. And you must also remember that the universities also have their own academic, programs and we link with them. Which means these students, besides getting academic support from the university, we are also having them. And this is when you see red, that is where they can be based. We're trying to have the students. But if you look at the majority of the students, they have that they have not faith with them. And with them, one of the reasons that makes our students who require voluntarily the academic support is because that criteria has when you get your, when you do employment placement, if you accepted academic support and you didn't pay, you know they have their own resources, you know they have their own assessment. And that is why our partners, they come on their own, most of them, they come on their own, and then we have them to pass. Then we have Stellenbosch, if you look at Stellenbosch, and the areas whereby you didn't indicate, so they are contact as well as the current contact. In this situation, it's whereby the students, they find themselves that they have lots of subjects. Why they have only to register that? They didn't register that subject. And then they stop the subject. But initially they requested, but they found that they are not going to go. And then that is why we find this previous process and this current process. And they, that is the city as well as the wash. Then I have a summary. Summary of what we of the assessment is that with University of Cape Town, remember there's a lot of subjects, but this was the total of the departments. They entered the departments that were in the city for a total of 7 subjects. 4 of us passed their subjects, 1 departments are receiving 1 subject each. Then there was a total of 4 of us and the 2 departments. If you will, you will notice that there's a lot of subjects, but you find out that the people who are doing the academic support, you will find out one person is doing a lot of academic support for various subjects because of the environment of the number of the other doing that. And a total of 4 partners is out of a total of 9 subjects. 3 partners passed their subjects. 1 partner is completing 1 subject. And there was also a decision, from my perspective, was carried, but one of them was a decision at the University of Stellenbosch. Cape Town University, a total of 14 partners. And I took a part in the support of the CUC for a total of 44 subjects. 8 partners passed all their subjects. 67 of the 44 subjects were passed, while 6 partners passed 16 subjects. Conclusion is that the aim of the Cultural Partner Program is not only to give funding or access to funding, it's also to make sure that we unlock their potential.
Thank you very much. Member questions? Member Mitchell, and Member Joseph, and Member Mosek, and Member Mitchell first.
Thank you.
school of skills in the waiting sector for maintaining yourself? And what consideration are they making for this doctor about education? What is the government can use for promoting the school of skills in your field and like myself? Thank you for being here. And using your instruction as well. This is a soft skill. And then the other thing that is a big worry for me is the institutional knowledge. You know, how do we internally build the capacity of people who come in internships of that Sunday academic time? Is there a school in the department that do that? And how should we? And what is it about if they start the school? And also the institutional knowledge of the people who are many years to transfer that knowledge. I know there's to feel that it's only about on these hospitals like government wants to compare the time for people with CCS all of them concerned about losing more institutional knowledge. But what is happening now in order for transfer that
knowledge?
Thank you very much, and again, thank you for your presentation. I just want to find out one of the my question is all the departments in the skills development are also talking about this because of the what I've identified of the huge needs. But the worry that I do have is the support that is here, okay, implementation level, and the from the primary level to the high school, we don't have, and it's affecting the rural areas now, talking about the rural areas now, we don't have students for mathematics. So, and we had an oversight deficit, I remember, in Costa Rica that one principal, we asked him that, what is the WLP? Because he was telling us that no, the students are so bad with mathematics. And I think we were there, and we asked the principal before he joined the department, and he said there's nothing we can do. And now that is the principal. In fact, he was the inspector, not the principal. Now, if the principal in the Department of Education says there's nothing we can do, maybe that if there can be skills to learn, has given up on those. And you are there at a certain level that you are waiting to grab them to say, now I'm going to move you forward. And you are not going, that means that school eventually is going to dry out. Now, how are we, and I know it's not your responsibility, unfortunately, you are the one who is in front of me. How are we going to get the kids that we can make it simple for them to access this information? And another one is the issue of Eastern Cape, and now it falls back on the whole society approach. We have the CDWs that they should be used to go to the rural areas and the school to talk to the kids, to introduce the ideas of you can work in the Department of Transport. All those copies that are, all those buzzers that they can access them. They need to have that information in the tutor center that a child works knowing that my goal is to get that brother, I'm going to work hard for that brother, because other kids, when you look at their circumstances, the social circumstances at home, doesn't see any hope. The only thing remaining is if I can be pregnant, that guy that is driving the truck will be able to maintain me, and I can have my own shed somewhere and then we'll start the family. Now, deeper than what we are trying to do, what I'm saying is that can we, when you meet with the other parties, can we start at the break there, because there is an age that we're going to meet in trying to really skill our kids to make sure that they access that the education that we want to. We have to have that information, but how do we go about to be proactive rather than reactive? What is important within the government? How do we go about? Because we have some of the mentality factors in the key mentality. And I'm going to say we, even though it's not us, to say message to the teacher that the teacher will go like,
has to be that way. I've never been that way. This deep card, I've never been that way. But now, the mindset of changing those keys, that's where I don't have the answer. That's where we have to come and say, how do we go about it? We have those keys that, when you buy the divine for the mother, we have the keys that are working.
Thank you.
this we still have this problem when a child goes to a disadvantaged school, still receives disadvantaged education. So the problem is when that child, like you say, when that child goes into tertiary education, then they struggle with that child. Now, I want to latch on what Mr. Chatham said. So if you track the child earlier, grade 10, and you maybe invest a bit in that child, then the program of 5 years should not be 5 years or 4 years. You should be on the level as the other children. So I'm just thinking of that because I know a lot of universities, they do extend it for disadvantaged children that come out of the girls, but I'm just thinking, you know, because that child also, when that child is grade 10 or something, the subject choices start and they don't have a hook. So if you don't intervene and assist them there, and I know it's an education thing, but I'm just saying, you know, if we talk about proactive, being proactive as a department, so if that child have a chance when they're younger, the probability for them going into the direction of their choice is better. I'm just thinking of that. And then, so that was mentioned. And then the other thing is, you know, the Rami Kutum is a good example. Why don't we, because a lot of schools also, I think, I saw this way. These elite schools go to the disadvantaged schools, you know, and assist those students and a lot of exchange. But I don't know when we can come to a point where we can say it's equal education. I don't know if we'll get there. Because my frustration is if you go to a council school, if a person gets accepted into a university, it's a big thing. But if you go to another school, if a person does not get in, that's a big thing. Yeah, that's vice versa. So I'm just asking how the department is assisting with that. And not from your job, not your job, but I'm just saying the work that you are doing, how can you assist that child and give that child a better chance at the end of the day? I'm going to give them a piece of opportunity to use the and then I'm going to ask you to answer. Thank you.
Thank you, Jay. Jay, I just want to latch on to what you're saying, but also just have to the assumption that the country school can't produce. I mean, a year, not 2 years ago, the top was in fact physics students got 100% out of the school in greater delivery. But
two out of 100. That's what I'm saying.
No, what I'm saying is you got two more.
No, what I'm saying is, sorry,
I'm
just saying it's 2 out of 100 that successfully there, it's 98% of the time.
But what I want to ask is, I know that, for example, at the University of Stellenbosch, they have a program called Schemat, which stands in mathematics for exactly that, to bridge the gap between a high school and the university that first year. The reality is that Schemat only has place for 3-4 learners a year. So my question is that how is there no way that the department could I don't want to say a memorandum of understanding, but some sort of link so that perhaps the funding that's available cannot be used to perhaps instead of having 3-4, but that you would subsidize those extra 6 or 8 or 10 learners in that program because once the learning is in that program, they become part of the university. To get into the engineering field is much easier than applying from the outside to the left and better world. Thank you
very much. And we're really not taking your core business away, but we're talking about an excellent job you're doing, and this is maybe some example of your business. So we're not saying take your core business away, and I know it's not your job, but we just added to this. Thank you, Mr. Lee.
Thank you,
Chair.
I'll ask the next. And if there's any that she wants to pass back to me or I'll add would you say?
Thank you, Rachel. Okay, I'm going to start with the one around the wellness level support that we are supposed to be giving. Okay, what is happening is that with education, I'm also leading to the external factors that I was talking about. With external factors, I would say the reality is, and we need to address that, the quality of education that the kids from the disadvantaged communities that are getting, that
Now, what we have from our side is that we have NGOs that are helping those kids. They are helping lesson business or undergraduates. That is why we have our partners that the NGOs, we don't want to have a situation whereby the NGOs, they have a shortage in terms of tutors. We get our consultants from partners to assist those NGOs so that they can help the kids that establish communities to get better math in relation to lesson business. And we have lots of NGOs that are working on a very secondary level. We have Bokobon, which is one of our partners. We have Tri at University. We also have meetings with University of Cape Town. You know what we do? We indicate to the university that this is what we have. And this is our criteria. And we need you to give students that training. And the students which we are talking about, which is from the university, was also another one that we didn't admit them after the selection process. There was a student who got A across all subjects. What happened when the students applied, or maybe the student didn't know about the program, I don't know, but the student never made the applied. But later, there was this student, remember with university, there was this student with A, but that student didn't have funding, but the student was admitted to university. What we did, we had to write a different submission for the HOD to approve, but that, which means that if there are students from the disadvantaged community, we're not able to get the bachelor when we're doing the selection process, but we can still see that they have potential. We make sure that there's an extra effort to make sure that they are accommodated. And in terms of the external factors that I'm talking about, one is the cost of education. You know that one is already sitting there. Because I don't know whether, don't even really know whether South Africa that there's an issue in terms of the cost of education. I don't know that if someone has not experienced that there's an issue in terms of the cost of education. Now, what we are doing in terms of that, we are trying to make sure that there is support that is happening. The university, the Department of Education, by the way, they have a good strategy around retirement. But I'm not sure how are they calling out and how is it being monitored. But there is a strategy around retirement because, as I was thinking, they are one of our members in our country. There is a strategy around making sure that there is availability in terms of men. And this is perfect. But there is a strategy, I don't know how it works because it's not like this. But I know for a fact it's something that they are doing. And as I said, there is a lot of work that we are doing. But as a department, we are not in a position to really do much. We can do it via NGOs, and that is how we are doing in terms of secondary level education to try and help. Which means that it's an effort that besides education. You know what is happening in South Africa, which I like, by the way, because it's everything in between the two, is that with admission for university, UCT and Stellenbosch, and with something we must be compromised. Quality of education, that is the compromise. Is that they require 75% and up for you to be admitted in the schools that I'm talking about. Now, what happens with the students coming from the first service? Remember, I come back to school here, the SAT says that we use a calculator, right? And remember the relation to personal education. For UCT and Stellenbosch, besides your academic report, they still have their own assessment. They need to assess you. And guess what happens? When they assess you, you are not allowed to use the calculator. And what happens? You fail. The students fail. Which means, that is why they are being those friends to their standard of education. As a teacher, you are supposed to know this is what is happening. Then you need to empower your kids to be able to use the calculator and be able to work without the calculator. Because you know, they are, for them to be admitted, they require that skill to be able to work without the calculator. No, those are the things that are really challenging and penalties which we are not in their position. But with our NGOs, because our NGOs, they will identify an area of concern and they try and work hard in terms of that requirement. Around the female and disability, as I said, we are waiting. We work with NGOs because not our corporation. But we have NGOs that work with people with disabilities and we make sure that they can ask the criteria of that. And we even if they have a person with disability and that child has been identified as being strong in the family, around the schools of excellence which we were talking about, we even inform the schools of because we have such a good relationship with schools. We know who's doing what in which schools. We know the good, we even know the good teachers. Which school is good, which is, like, a lot of things that we know about education when it comes to lessons. We are in a position to say, you know, at that school day, we can't have to be able to do a way of accommodating. And now we're speaking on behalf of the students with the schools of excellence that this They're not saying they must, what, they mustn't use their criteria. We're not saying they must collect. We're not saying they just say, hey, this student apply and then you look whether it's a failure. No, there's lots of things to them to try. But unfortunately, we don't have the power to make decisions. Our job is to just be decisions. They do, they do, they do, that's what we do. We do work with schools of excellence. And what else? When it comes to the thinking, I know the schools are competent. I also know that there are areas in rural areas where there's lots of schools. Guess what? There's nothing to put that upon the and if you do have a school that's upon the maybe it's upon a net, just upon a net. And in order for you to be admitted for these things, you need more. You know, and there's so many things, that is why I say, when it comes to education, that's really what's so important. I don't know. Then, at the institutional level, around institutional level, we have what we call professional development. When we get our students to the end, okay, once our partners have graduated, they get to the employment department. And once they get to the employment in the department, they get mentors. And those mentors, they can start to get professional development. And it's that means practice for them to get professional. That means they that transfer of skills is that institutional level. And so, by the way, we have like 8% of people. Remember, in order to get professional development, you need to go and try to test. You need to do something. There's a lot of other things that you need. You need to start with support. And there was more much of because their communities are that way. Our communities, they manage to get professional education. I have the breakdown of the bathroom. We normally have it in our annual report. And it's really good. We are not spreading. Yeah, it is really good. We try and make sure that I always say, when you talk about disadvantaged community, that has nothing to do with it. It has to do with being disadvantaged. And people within our university is a very good reflection of what South Africa has. And what does the next question talk about?
There's a question about revisiting in terms of the policy strategic goals. So obviously in this context for us, it links into provincial strategic goal 2, which is around education outcomes and so on. And also actually our content is in PSG 1, so around creating opportunities for growth and jobs, because what we're trying to do is build the skills, the number of people in the economy that got the skills that ultimately the economy needs to be able to grow. So for us as a department, we see it fitting in that broad context. Obviously, as a department, we have objectives that speak to, you know, creating opportunities, upskilling, etc., within our own department. And if I may, link then to the question through you, Chair, that Honourable Chacham asked about TVETs and TVET colleges. And we have got other programs in the department which are after-learning based and apprenticeships. So we're trying to understand that we've got different aspects, different programs dealing with different responses. So trying to acknowledge that what this Masaki Sizwe program is trying to do is trying to target people at the university and technical university. What the artisan and apprenticeship program is trying to do is target exactly that, building artisan skills, taking people through their through both the practical as well as the written test so that people can be registered as skilled artisans in plumbing and welding and carpentry and so on. So it's a small program, again, budget related. We don't have that many, but we've got a program that focuses on that. Then we've got the contractor development program and so on. So we've got a number of the different levels. The other aspect about what are we doing to promote this. So the data has indicated that we go out to schools. We also then, the team go out to Tucson centers, and when there are invisos and open days, the data team are actually there with the application forms trying to sell the program that we put and get it out there as widely as possible. Through the Department of Education, actually sending applications to schools as well, when we know the maths and science is being offered, to try and draw applicants in that way. We also advertise, so through the community newspapers and so on, we also advertise that there's opportunities available and on our website and so on. So we try to promote
doesn't necessarily promote itself per se. I mean, as you know, we obviously issue press releases about our work and what it is that we do and what we deliver. But it is something also that as a department we've been talking about, because what we deliver is something that people can have incredible pride in being able to touch and feel, and be able to say, I was a part of that, and say to their kids and their grandkids, you know, I was involved in building that, or making the decision to build that. And that's something that I believe that our department, in trying to communicate and almost establish the rapport with the community of being able to attract future employees to the department, that's something that we have got as a unique selling point in terms of the kind of value that we add. So we haven't been very good at it necessarily. Engineers and architects are not very good at those things. So it is something that we've identified that we need to do a lot more of, and be able to explain to people almost what the world would be like if transport and public works didn't exist. Because if you start to imagine a world without us delivering, the mere fact that offices are cleaned, that there's toilet paper in toilets, tends to happen because transport and public works exist. Those things wouldn't happen if we don't exist. You wouldn't have a school, you'd be teaching under a tree or in a field. You wouldn't have a hospital, you wouldn't have a clinic, you wouldn't have a road, you wouldn't have a bus that you can get on. So very often it's easier to explain how it would be different if you didn't exist than trying to blah 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 what we do. And that's something that we're starting to work on. Your question about the institutional management, as Lekker spoke about the occupational development program and the nature that we have, when we bring the graduates from our program, those that we've employed in the Department of Canvas. But Honourable Member Joseph mentioned it on the DSP, and you would have seen in the press, it was recently as something that's come back on the table as part of the recent wage negotiations. And he asked around what institutional memory we will lose as a department if everybody in our department who's over 60 decided that they wanted to take that package and it was approved. I can tell you now, because one of my staff members actually asked me the question, if you take a top quote, actually, how many years' experience would you lose in terms of the VHP? And because we're planning on talking about it in our chat plan tomorrow. And I said, around about 3,000 years' experience in terms of institutional memory. He said, you know, you're actually very close, 3,450. So if everybody in our department over 60 took the VHP, if this comes on the table, we will lose 3,450 years worth of institutional memory in government. So it's quite something for us as a department, and why the mentoring and the linkages and the promotion of that sort of engagement and interaction is vitally important. And then just a couple of other points as well that were flagged, and the urban-rural divide. My recollection, and they can correct me if I'm wrong, is that we say that urban is deemed to be city of Cape Town, so the municipal area of the city, rather than just a little rural space that's closer to the city, but ultimately, to make it a little easier, rural is everything outside of the city of Cape Town. So even though in George, you've got an urban centre, we're saying anybody who comes from outside of the city of Cape Town is deemed to be coming from a rural area. Because otherwise, if we start to try and demarcate whether, you know, is your residence in the centre of George, or are you in Timberlake, or are you in Blanco, or it becomes very complicated. So it's a lot easier just to kind of give that division. The other reason for it is that one of the problems, or let me say, one of the approaches around Nsati Sizwe and understanding of what Nsati Sizwe means about building the nation is that we have fully acknowledged that the professionals that come through the program and the graduates that come through don't all have to come and work with ETW. There are many of them because of our partnerships with the private sector that go and work with the private sector. And ideally, we also want people who are going to go back and work in the municipalities. Because remember, that's all things, the kind of municipalities don't have engineers and architects and quite exist. So we want to be able to create opportunities, and we believe that you're more likely to have somebody who's prepared to go and work in both of the West if they've got a link with both of the West, if they come from both of the West, or have something there. Sorry? But for example, I can say that one of our youngsters who come through our program, our working program, went through our professional development program, and is now stationed and appointed in the district roads engineer office in Oakland. He comes from Oakland. His family is in that area. That's where he wants to be. He doesn't want to be in the CBD. He doesn't want to be in Cape Town. So by being able to identify people who come from outside of the city, we're also hoping that we are able to bring, get those people back to those areas for future. Then the discipline. Yes, so how do we keep discipline? Very good question. We have a mother hen who is an absolute disciplinarian, I think, in terms of the team. Keeps them on the straight and narrow. And we're trying to ensure that our students, we interact with them on a regular basis. We have got campus coordinators, so we've got people of our staff who are linked directly to each campus, and that interact on a regular basis with the students at that campus. So are able to deal with any reports of any problems, any issues, and resolve them then and there. So that's also one mechanism, and maybe more that the data can indicate. We do not allocate bursaries for people studying in the marine or aviation sectors. Okay, we do not issue bursaries for that at this point. It's mechanical, electrical, chemical, geological, all of those sorts of areas, but certainly not marine or aviation at the moment. And the reason for it really is that this program was started because our department identified a need for skill sets. And our department doesn't have any mandate in the aviation or marine environments, and therefore are not issuing bursaries for those particular areas. Otherwise, we might be asked by FERPA, why are you spending public money for a skill that you're never going to use? So at this point, we don't issue bursaries for those particular fields. Then the tracking of earlier, the other question around whether we're tracking earlier from grade 10 and Chen, you asked the question around the subject choices. So as Vivek has mentioned, we do have the NGO screen in link. But if I could give them perhaps my passion, my view is that as one honorable member who spoke about the point that if as a child you're told that age 10 or age 11 that you can't do maths, you're going to believe them. You're going to believe the person who tells you that. And I have that within my family context. My sister-in-law was told when she was about, I think 11 years old, by a teacher, you're useless to maths. You haven't got a cooking clue what you're doing. And she took that to heart. And I can tell you that all the way through high school, and actually she didn't finish high school because she was atrocious at maths, because she took that particular belief to heart. So I'm a firm believer that in many respects, it's almost too late, grade 10. The foundation for maths and the foundation for science comes at a primary school level, where you instill the passion, the interest, the love for numbers, and what that means for you. And at this point, our department isn't reaching down to that level. We're picking them up more through the NGOs at the high school level. And that's where I think at the primary school level we've actually got to do something fundamental. Because even then when you go into high school, you're moving into maths literacy. And you can't be doing maths literacy, even if you get wonderful marks, 90% maths literacy, you're not going to get into a higher education institution to do engineering or architecture with maths literacy. So I do think that there's a lot of work that still needs to happen there. The suggestion around subsidizing people in like the master's program from the University of Stellenbosch and so on, that's definitely something. I don't know whether team looked at that, but we can certainly take that board as an idea, and we can see whether it's something, obviously funds and all the rest of it, depending, but we can certainly try and pursue. That's a wonderful idea, and we can try and pursue if there are opportunities there. Thank you.
Can I ask if you have a system of making those kids that went through the channel of the Bangalore to be ambassadors to motivate the other students to retain their rank where they come from those disadvantaged, you know, because it is, then it's important that maybe they can be used to say, look, I've been there, done that, and this is where I am, for them to be motivated to say, you know, it can be said in a mission, the cement plate in when he passed Monday, we said they are African, tried to get an assistance for more than 4 years, and they wanted around that area of Monday and Citrus Valley. From that area, they couldn't get a student that they wanted from Cape Town here. And we have a lot of kids that have never seen out of their rural areas. And when I'm saying rural areas, I mean, that they've never seen anything better than the small town that they are in. That when you teach them about a simple joke, like I said, see the lot of water around there, don't have a clue of what are you talking about, why don't they need to say there's no water in Cape Town, but you say there's a lot of water around Cape Town. It doesn't make sense to them that they end up also a simple thing as a joke and not being interested to them that they can't be there. So I'm just unpacking the challenges that to us is a simple thing, but for those kids, like me being born in the and when you could say that there's a high above sea level, there's a student, you're getting a very minimum mass for your platform, didn't make sense to me. Now, it's one of the things that we are talking about, that from the primary classes, where you can get the teachers that are motivated. I agree with the NGOs to come in, but we do have the culture that the parents also have. The teacher is always alive. So even if you can introduce the NGO, they're going to look at the NGO and look at the teacher will be like, so I don't know how are you going to do it. Like I mentioned before that I'm throwing it to you again when you interact with the Department of Education that you need to have people that are passionate about that to really help our kids, to help the rural areas that they can do that. Thank you, Chair.
Did you want to respond?
Okay. In terms of the ambassador aspect, we have already started doing that. Remember, what we are doing in terms of this program, besides giving the ambassador, is to instill sense of social responsibility from our ambassador. Why do we have a social responsibility? When do we have a social responsibility? When do we have a professional with a social responsibility? What do we do with the candidates? Our candidates, they are assisted the ones working with us since they are last year, they are final year. And what do we do when we are promoting Massachusetts Web, especially for those holidays? We already have a list of the students that in this area, so many students are going to be there. And then they will be part of us. They will be, instead of us as the official say there's a massacre to but that, then we have a person from the area who will be saying, I am one of the beneficiaries of this program is in our hands. We have already done that and created happy. The only case is the fact that when you go outside the top court, people they start to come in. I think I'm not sure whether their confidence is destroyed. They start when you talk about university. They see the candidate is very fast. And they attended in terms of this, they become don't get the number we are looking at. Because the aid is not only about the people who are there. It's for other people to also to know that there is something like this. But in terms of the attendance, people are or maybe remember the time when we get actual data to market in their area is the only school holiday. In winter, maybe it's cold, people they don't have, I'm not sure what the area is. And during summer, during December, everything else is very education. But we don't really have, we have certain, but it's not working the level we would like. We'd like to have more people coming so that there's a lot of people who know about the problem. But it's a matter of, they always
they have the shepherd for the because what we have told them is that, you know, our country, it's our collective responsibility to the human. You have a part to play. I have a part. You as an individual have a part. And this is your part. If you don't know your part, you know your part. This is the part that you need. And equally.
Thank you. Can we move on to the next topic? Thank you very much for that. The report we could get from the 1975 year and also how you minimize that was. Thank you very much, Ms. Lee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Johan Fabricius, the Director for Financial Accounting will do the presentation. I'm asking the chairman to make it not to accountant speak, but he was just talking to the Public Accounts Committee. I'm sure that actually you'll understand the topic than I in terms of the presentation.
Thank you very much, Elizabeth. Just a short background on content accountancy, on the background taking attempt to recruit a little bit. The financial status that we've done on the 31st of March 2017, and we've taken it a year on to the 31st of March 2018, and the interventions that we've done from the 1st of April. And I can't go to the background. Previously, it was bad to write off any debt in government services. Whether you get your own legal process, and you get to the end of that, there's no way that you're going to get this money in. So you have to write it. It was seen as a very bad thing. And then there was, at this stage, a lack of policies relating to pensioners and the indigenous tenants. The indigenous tenants, if somebody has saved enough, has lost his job, can't pay, but he's still paid. He's still living there, he can't pay it out. And he might come right, he might get a job in, and he might still get paid as a debt. Then the inherited debt is what we get from, let's say, agriculture don't want to use their housing, they increase it to us, and we in charge of those housings now, because it's part of our custodian processes, but we also inherited the debt that this housing that we got. Now, on the 31st of March 2017, our historical debt to the value of 89 million rand. That was rental debt. And the main rental debt, typically we've broken it down to two categories, commercial and private. We looked at it and we said, but we've got a little more debt categories as commercial and private. And we started breaking it down to a more, I don't want to call it a user-friendly, but just that you can see where your debt is really and what is the problem around it. And what we've done is also we've combined a task team constituted to try and to address the outstanding debt. And the team consists of senior management, and of course directors from management accounting, from financial accounting, and chief directors as well. Brainstorming sessions was held by the team. The interventions identified and implemented by the categorization of the debt into homogeneous groups. That's what I was talking about previously, just commercial and private, and that was our two groups. We've broken it down to more to see what is really in it. Clean up of information is in the debt, if we don't present the data and we sure that the data is 100% correct, then obviously our outstanding debt is a skewed picture, so we started cleaning it up. Allocation of money from suspended account, sometimes we do get money in, it's in our bank account, but with no reference on it. So we put it onto the suspense account. The past year I could say that we closed with a suspense account of 9,000 rand that we really couldn't even contact with the bank. We just couldn't get to who this 9,000 belonged to, who paid it into our bank account. Then the methodology for dealing with each category. And here we're talking about pensioners. Now we have to do market-related results. Pensioner that gets a such a pension, we can't charge him market-related. He's never going to be able to pay it, and it's just escalating and escalating, we don't stop it. So we have to go to provincial treasury and ask how can we deviate from market-related rental for certain groups. This is the criteria that we want to put in place, but this is how we're going to. And then the question is, do we write off the debt that is up there at the moment with the Sasha people, or do we like it back and say these people could never really afford it? So let's not write it off, but let's do a correction on those specifically debt accounts. Then there's the efficient means of the writing up of debt. Where we said previously you think one write-off to a person and then you've got 20, so you amalgamate all 20 and put it all together that belongs together and write off through one submission to get it through the system quicker. Legal services and state attorney engagements that we've done, and then policy requirements between what we are talking about, the pensioners parking to be updated and the indigenous people that stayed in our rental accommodation. If I go to the financial status, this is the rental debt. On the 31st of March last year, it was 89,000 rand. 89 million? Sorry, 89,000 rand, everybody would have been very happy. On the 31st of March this year, it came down to 80 million rand. So we're not talking about the old debt on the 89 million rand. The historic debt in that, and that means of older than a year, was 63 million rand. In the current year, the older debt than a year is 57 million rand. So we did make a dent into the historic debt, if I could get with the equipment on that. I could also just mention that the amount of money that we earned this year on rental was close to 20 million rand more than the previous year that we did got into our bank account. Now, at this stage, of the 80 million rand of the 31st of March, 41 million rand is at the moment at the state attorney. And at the state attorney, there's a lot of these pensioner rentals as well. And if we could get the policy through that we could, let's say, collect those pensioners, we could actually take those away from the state attorney because we're never going to get that money. People can't afford it. So, and collect it, and that will mean that after, let's say, the 80 million rand through this process, close to 10 million rand will be corrections. Not necessarily write-offs, but corrections because you'll never be able to get that money in. Then the next one is the staff debt. Now, the bursary one on the staff debt, that's not employees, that's people that we've given the bursaries to. And I must admit, this bursary debt is really, it's old debt. It looks much better now. It didn't really grow. You can see that we even got a little bit of money back. At this stage, that debt that's sitting there between the two financial years is when we started with the bursary program and people that didn't complete, and now the debt is sitting there. But this debt will also be written off because remember, this is people that we're trying to help. They don't have the financial means to pay it back. So we have to say, at the end of the day, close to that 1.7 million rand, all they bring for the legal processes will be written off. And can push very hard to write it off this financial year that we are in. But furthermore, the debt of the employees is quite high, but that's basically leave without pay. And pillar cases. Now, what happens in a pillar case, the person completes the pillar forms, they get rejected, and then they lost all for a month. And then we have to take on the debt because we have to recover it from the individual. The problem now is that previously we could deduct it from the salary. Now, I think at the beginning of the year, and I'm not very wrong with the dates now, I can't deduct anything from somebody's salary without these functions. And a lot of the OED salary overpayments, the people are contesting it and saying, but listen, I was appointed, that was my agreement, and that's what I'm getting at. Now, when we go through the processes of saying you have to pay back that money, they're contesting it. And they're saying, but hang on, just to take one example, and it's a fair question. One of the engineers, or upcoming engineers, he did qualify, he completed these. All these academic records, he was successful. Then he has to register at the engineering council. But that has taken close to 6-7 months. But is he now an engineer? Isn't he? He completed and now he isn't, but he was studying on IIT. So now that condition is. It was not my mistake. I've given all the registration forms when I completed my studies and I was successfully. The engineering council is taking 2 to 6 months to get me registered, but I can't fault them because I completed my tertiary education that I have, and now they're contesting it. So it's that type of thing that we're sitting with the heads of employees at this stage. Then the system total of 3.5 million is also at the state of planning for possible recovery of that 4.985 million rate at the current financial year, or the past financial year. And then in the department, we've got another outstanding debt of 400,000 rand to actually be processing it. It's writing the letters. We normally give 2 letters before we hand it over to the state attorney or legal services to get the money back. If you read through all the scripts and everything on outstanding debt, they say if you really don't get your debt within the 30 days, you're really going to struggle to get your money back. So that's why normally the policy that we got, our debt policy that was issued by the provincial treasury, but we adopted it, we shortened it that we get the letters quickly to the individual, and not the 3 letters, but just 2 letters to get it through the legal processes to get it in quicker. Any interventions being implemented since April 2017? They want to stop or after I think we I don't know many of these. But just when somebody comes and rents one of our properties, that property or that rental agreement get very quickly to the finance section so that they could actually take it onto the system, that you don't have the 2 or 3 months before it gets to the system and the person is already in the house, and then you've got, before that even started, you started with a backlog. Furthermore, that we've got funded for a additional credit controller and a financial controller. The difference between a credit controller and a financial controller is basically the credit controller gives you all the guys that saying you say you owe me so much, when are you going to pay, and that type of thing. The financial controller looks over the whole accounting on the debits and the credits of all the individual creditors or debtors that we've got. Legal services, that's the engagements we had 4 monthly meetings. It actually came down now to monthly meetings with these on the outstanding debt and the cases that we're doing at the moment. And what we also decided on is to address the top 30 rental agreements. That's 26% of our outstanding debt, and put all the effort into to get that rating. And then you will take off 26% of your total outstanding debt on a rental agreement.
Thank you very much. Members' questions? Member Joseph?
Thanks, Mr. President. Just clarity on the point raised about the authority dealing with the categories of figures on extensions. I want to know if there's a policy, when did that policy come in, or did Treasury approve, you know, your
We still don't
Treasury approved that policy in terms of the revision of that policy, and if not, are you still continuing on the market related prices and with the legal process you were discussing? I must tell you, this area, we must previously what comes with people in the world, to carry the port to school, those days, really big challenges in the government departments. But market prices for people who work for the government for so many years, they couldn't afford a house, not food. They work for the government. You know, and it's separation between the government and the taxation stations and the owners, whatever your person is, that's obviously. But I think the question I want to ask, how much money do we spend on getting the money? And because we have such a large orientation department, I think there's a second thing that comes in terms of how long and how much money go people with local government who have come forth to say in the data. to example, don't expect you to mention the city, but just give an example of who are they living in that city and what's the kind of money that they owe.
She'll give some feedback on the pension policy and the parking aspects of things, and then Joanna will pick up on the other points.
Thank you, Kim. So, the whole issue here was what you saw under the old historic debt is that all the debt were basically thrown into one pot. And there wasn't a clear line of sight as to what did this entail. What is it that sits in the number of transactions? And the biggest load from a volume perspective was parking, old parking debt. And it was actually, from a monetary perspective, it was insignificant. From an accounting and a debt management perspective, because of the numbers, it becomes significant. Specifically, if you're saying you can't manage the debt that seems the smallest, the easiest, and the most simple in comparison to everything else. So what we did under the task team is this task team I actually set up last year towards the end of the year. Because some of it was understanding what is going on and why can't we deal with it. Now one of the major issues and concerns from a departmental perspective is, and by all means I'm not making an excuse and we are not, I don't want to sound like a victim, but the reality is, the same staff that is making this debt is the same staff that is trying to get to all of the municipalities for our rates accounts to process those for our services accounts, etc., which is a nightmare on its own. And I needed to find a way to understand what is contained in here and to bring the finance sections and the immovable asset management section together so that we can leverage off the joint resources, what is it that we can clear out of the books. Now from a parking perspective, something as simple as you are entitled to parking, but the time that it takes for the CSC to load it on their stuff so that it can be deducted of your salary is anything between a week and a year. By that time, you already have historic debt of a year. And this is what builds up the same employee that leaves. By the time it is processed, a year has gone by. So you've left already bringing it to the ex-employee situation where you picked up that they never discontinued your use of parking and therefore their account on PERSA, which is an administrative process. So for us, it's not really understanding what's a big ticket item. Who owes the government real money? And where is the money lying that is in theory owed but it's not real? It's not, we are not entitled to it. If you've left government and you no longer use that parking, me wanting that money from where is unjustified and ridiculous, which is what we needed to distinguish from what is real. That's why we characterize it and that's why we were looking from something as insignificant as parking for a big ticket item. Some of the big ticket items in your annual speaker, but the major one is the universities. The major one is the universities. With whom we have agreements and who have agreements with the Department of Health, etc., and who owes us huge amounts of money and from whom we have managed to get quite a large quantum of the old outstanding debt in these last couple of months. As it pertains to policies, one of the issues for us, as you rightly said, is that when you look at who lives or who is in the accommodation, and therefore what is their ability to repay us, even before the question is asked, are we going to spend money paying a debt collector to go after these people and getting the money, you need to understand who are you wanting to get it from. So therefore, we've done the analysis to say, this is a supplementation. How is the department can be justified paying millions of friends, but they could let the picture is a friend channel, it is not going anywhere, they can simply not by you because they don't have the money. And if that kind of exercise has been just tried, then this all we come to the accounting expert and therefore identify what they think the policy is relevant, does it make sense? Is it logic? And for us, therefore, the review of the policies was set as top of the agenda. So that change review is on my list of things to do for this current year, other than just getting rid of old debt. So getting the debt is the one side of it, but fixing the policies that almost lend itself to incurring these debts is the other part, which is what we have identified. And unfortunately, we couldn't deal with all of that in the time period from when we established this committee to now. But what we did do is to identify all of the gaps in the current old, I must say, age-old policy, which are not relevant, which doesn't make sense, and which does not consider the circumstances or the background against which you explain five-star ministers such as daughter, etc. And we need to deal with this on its own merits, state by state, which complicates matters, because this sort of context is quite important when we are reviewing the policies.
Could I also, just before you speak, just to flag, make sure that there isn't a misunderstanding. The ex-employee's debt that was just commenting and referring to spoke about 47%. That's the increase. I just want to make sure we understand that the debt that is in your ex-employee is gone from 893,000 to 1.321 million. So just to understand, that's the quantum that was in that. So the increase from 1 year to next is quite large. But just to flag that it's not the total debt in terms of what's owed to the employee, or the start date, is 1.321 for each employee. Just to correct that if there was any misunderstanding. Mr. Richard, do you want to respond to all the other questions that passed?
I'll do that. Just coming back to the ex employees again, close to 40% is two cases of people who were dismissed. We went through court cases. We did recoup from the pension going through the legal processes. You have to go through the legal process to recoup from the pension fund. We did get all the pension money from the individual back, but the outstanding amount is still 400,000 rand. So, and the person is not about anymore, so there's 400,000 in that pension employee's money that. The chances are very good that we have to write that amount off as well. And then there's another amount of plus minus 250,000 grand that will more or less go the same price as that. So, although it's an ex-employee, there's two, basically the half of the amount of two employees that were dismissed for missing work and everything like that. So, although the picture looks extreme, it's those two big ones that make that amount up. Just coming back to the state attorney did say to us, any debt under 3,000 rand, they're not interested. It's not for them feasible to even go through a whole legal process, it's just not cost effective. So go through your own processes, and if you're not going to recoup that money, write it off and get it out of your books. That's basically what they call us down to. Coming back to my Peter Dresden, previously it was quite easy to, before the person resigned, to recoup the money from the pension fund, but obviously people did complain. I'm not talking about for our department, I'm talking about our country, and it's not that easy to recoup the money from the pension fund unless you go through a legal process as well, ensuring. Now what we do, we do instate a credit or a debit against the pension fund, and yes, they do sometimes pay it back to us and say that especially if you could prove that the person was resigned but he or she was actually close to fire, and then they tend to do pay that money or that debt that owed to the government, they do pay it back, but the real correct procedure is that you have to go through a legal process ensuring that all the T's are crossed, because the individual could come back to you and say, but you were not allowed to deduct that pension, even from the pension fund. You were not allowed to deduct it. So that's why we went with this one individual through the whole legal process, and we did get all the pension that was available to us from, and she can't turn it back to us because we went through the whole legal process to get that money. And then just, I should have mentioned it, but from the outstanding staff there, there is R1 million that we're covering through a salary, basically debit orders or deducted from the individual salary, or even some of the fees that you know that the pension fund. So from that R4.985 million, R1 million is the people are paying for at the moment. You're not going to see a big shift in it, but we have to take into account all the individuals' financial positions before I could actually put any deduction to the salary. And then I'm also blocked. I can't get anyone to home with less than I might have the amount wrong. It's either R2,300 a month or R2,500. It went up a little bit. So we're not allowed that anybody go home after any deduction on their salary was less than R2,500. It's either R2,300 or R2,500. So that's what we're doing at the moment with all that. FET College. The outstanding debt on them was R19 million, I think, at year end, previous year. And we got that figure down to R11 million at year end at this year. And the bulk of that city outstanding amount is the FET colleges. And I don't know, I shouldn't say this, but some of them are even our own department, National Department of Public Works, that's renting the Alfred Street complex from us. But they did undertake to pay it back and to do that. So, but the bulk of it is, so we're not saying I'm going to concentrate on these 50 payments or 50%. It's the money that I'm quite sure I will be getting back. The FET colleges, they don't really have that excuse. What they normally do is just prove it again to us. Just prove it again that you owe the money and we didn't pay. But that's more or less the end of that day, not much more than that.
On page 57, under debt, employees consist of a new debt, legal uptake. Now, please explain that to me. If I go on legal uptake, how do I owe you money? How am I indebted to you?
The personal family, I'm 60 days. And when he comes back to the office, no 60 days anymore. Or even with the cash and relief, I've got something that's going on at home, the visa at birth, I can't come into work, but he's used all his leave, whether sick or the other way around. So now he comes in completely for. But they say, so it must be getting deducted from each other because that's in the book out there.
Thank you very much. I think that's the end of it. Thank you very much, HP, and thank you very much for your passionate staff. We appreciate your presentation throughout the meeting. Thank you very much. Materials is just a little afterwards.